Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Loken, Judge Smith, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Good morning. Our only case this morning is A21-1427. I hope I pronounced this right. Herlack versus Rux. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument. And then finally, appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. As you are aware, this is a Zoom argument. It is being recorded. However, our rules prohibit anyone, either counsel or the parties or any observers from making their own recordings. So please respect that. With that, whenever you're ready, counsel for the appellant, you may begin. But first, tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning. My name is Susan Minsberg. I represent the appellant, Amy Rux. I want to thank the panel for your kindness in rescheduling this argument. I'm actually, as you can hear, I'm still recovering, but I really appreciate your consideration. This case is about a couple who invested money into Ms. Rux, the appellant's home. The issue is, what is the respondent, entitled to from his investment? Mr. Herlosh sued my client for unjust enrichment. He did not sue in contract. So the issue is not what did the respondent give to the appellant, because it's an unjust enrichment case, how was appellant enriched? And what you need to look at is, in real estate cases, there are very specific tests which indicate how someone is enriched. And I believe the reason for that is that just because you invest money into a house doesn't mean you get that money back. So the only way—
Minsberg, in the two cases you cite, both Nylands and Marking, is it correct that in both of those cases, there really wasn't a cash sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, payment, but it was more the party seeking unjust enrichment had provided labor and or materials? Am I, first of all, right about that?
So my understanding that Marking is slightly different than I don't know if it's Nylands or Nylands, Your Honor, but in Marking, it was labor and materials. I don't believe that any subcontractors were hired in Marking. I don't believe that's the case in Nylands. Significant dollars were invested. Now, counsel for respondent tries to distinguish those cases, saying, well, in those cases, cash was not given to the fee owner. That really doesn't matter, because what matters is what went into the house itself, and whatever dollars went into the house, did they increase, the market value of the house? And that is—
As counsel, then let's just say that, person A has two accounts, her checking account, and then she starts another account. And then person B, who she lives with and, you know, is planning a future, puts $150,000 in that account that's going to pay the bills on the planned renovations. Instead, person A decides to use other money to pay her bills on the renovation. You know, she gets whatever, a bonus or whatever. And then at $150,000 in the other account that the person B put in just sits there, and she just keeps it as a savings account. You're saying that if there's, you know, a basis for not, there's basis for liability, that the court couldn't give back that $150,000 that she kept in savings because other money was, she spent other money of her own toward her own house?
So, Your Honor, I'm not entirely clear if I understand the scenario. Are you saying that the non-fee owner puts $150 into an account that's used for the house?
That's they presume is going to be used for the house, but she ends up not using it on the house. She uses her own dollars out of her checking account. So that $150,000 just stays there, and she just keeps it as savings. And he says, I want it back, and sues. The district court can't give it back?
I think So I haven't analyzed that fact situation, but I think it's
Well, let me help you, Ms. Mintzberg. In that situation, couldn't you sue that, or could put person A sue person A for theft? The question is not, could she get the money back? It's how could A get the money back, depending on what A pleaded?
Because in that case, that seems like theft by swindle. I mean, that's a case where you misrepresent the reason that you're taking the funds, and then you don't use them for that reason. So maybe that's some sort of theft. It seems like it. So that is a little bit different than our case, where the money is given for a specific purpose and it was used for that purpose. There was no misrepresentation. So I agree, it's an interesting issue, but I don't know that it's close enough on point that figuring out the answer there.
I'll make it no intent to misrepresent. I'm just trying to point out dollars are fungible. Bills come in, they get paid. What difference does it make? And if at the end of the day, you have dollars that came in for future bills that she's going to have to pay. This isn't like, oh, I lived on a farm and I like painted it and kept it up to date, and then my parents didn't sell it to me like I planned. You know, I put in a basement and I did all this work. She had bills that she had to pay. He gave money that paid. She didn't have to use other money then. She could buy a car. She could do whatever she wanted with her other money. I don't really understand with fungible dollars why that can't be a measure for damages, for what a person should get back, assuming the liability.
So here's what I think the distinction is, Judge Smith, is that in this case, they each put a bunch of money into the real estate. And when you have real estate, how do you decide, because it's unjust enrichment, it's not contract, right? It wasn't just what did he give. That's what the unjust enrichment law talks about. It's how was she enriched, right? That's what an unjust enrichment case is.
Isn't she enriched by not having to pay those bills? She got to use the money on something else.
Oh, if she didn't spend any of her money, for sure, Your Honor, that could be an issue. However, as the documents show, she spent $750,000 of her own money that went directly into the house. And much of the money, or roughly half of the money that the trial court awarded to the respondent, was money that was not invested into the house. It was for attorney's fees, it was for maintenance, it was for other personal expenses. So because this is an unjust enrichment case, what you have to look at is, what did the money do? Right, if it was a contract, Your Honor, absolutely. I give you X, you get X, we agreed you get X back, that's a breach of contract case. But because this is real estate, the respondent would have to show, okay, first of all, the value to the real estate as a result of both of the investments went from X to Y. And then, and an expert would have to determine that.
Counsel, can I stop you there? Because I understand your argument to be the district court didn't apply the right damage measure. He just said it, he gets what he paid. But on the other hand, the district court made some statements in its order about he contributed to the increased value of this house, he gets his money back. So a person could look at that and think, well, the district court, you know, implicitly concluded that, you know, his contributions increased the value to at least the amount of his contribution. Because we've got case law that's saying you can't get more than you contributed back. And if we look at it that way, assuming that the district court doesn't err, then the next question would be, what evidence in the record supports that reasoning? And what I, and maybe you could tell me, but I would be looking for, what did she pay to purchase the house? What was the house worth when he came on board and started contributing? What was it worth when the relationship soured? What did it sell for? Do we have any information about any of those numbers?
Judge Larkin, you are 100% on point as to what was required. And that's what this court has told us we need to do. And there was no evidence of any value except for what she sold it for 2.5 years after he left.
After he left. And, I lost it. Continue. I'm sorry to interrupt.
So, I get
the argument, and you've certainly got case law that seems to suggest, but, you know, I mean, it is, well, first of all, it's sufficiency of the evidence, right?
Mm-hmm. There was.
Well, I mean, that's the standard in a court trial. You know, there has to be sufficient evidence, and obviously you have to apply the correct law. But so he did give her, I think, a check for about 30 grand to fix the well. Okay. Now, I would assume a house with a broken well is worth less than a house with a well that is working. Well, you know, I mean, I just would. So at a minimum, maybe it would have been better if he had an expert to testify that, well, you know, when you have a well that works, it increases the value of a house $50,000. Okay. But I would think that the 30 grand is at least a floor that, under a sufficiency of the evidence standard, gets you to say, well, you know, one assumes that it's at least that's at least the minimum amount that was contributed to the value. Now, why am I wrong under your theory of the case?
So, my gosh, Your Honor, I don't like to say you're wrong.
You're the only one, so join the club. Feel free.
So the issue is, first of all, it wasn't 30,000. The well was roughly 23,000, and then other money was used to buy an elliptical for her birthday. So if you look at the evidence, the trial court said, well, there wasn't evidence of how much money he actually gave her, because that could never be found. What it was a counter withdrawal. But still, this court has said, you have to say how that increased the value. I mean, in the Markin case, which is a relatively short opinion, it was said five ways, how you had to show an increase in value to the real estate.
So counsel, if this was cars, they both shared a love of Porsches, and they decided to buy themselves a bunch of Porsches with whatever amount of money that he put in. And she did, and then she kept them, titled them and herself, and kept them. You don't need to prove the value of that. But because it's real estate based on marking, it's a different measure of damages.
You do, if someone were to sue an unjust enrichment in your example, Judge Smith, with the Porsches, you'd have to show how was the person enriched. So there is.
And she kept the Porsches. So she kept the Porsches, and he paid for them. Do you have to show an increase in value of the, what's the measure of damages? Why isn't the price of them a reasonable amount?
So so it's a little bit different, because was it a gift? Was it a contract claim?
Nope. This is all unjust enrichment. They planned to have it. You have to accept my premises. It's unjust enrichment. There's liability. She's keeping the cars. They plan to both enjoy on the weekends.
So the question would be, how is she enriched? And I have
got
to
a say, car.
Yeah, she got the Porsches.
She got a car.
Right. So what is the value? And I have to be honest, I don't know what the case law says, how you determine the proper damage amount. Is it the current value of the Porsche? Would it be the replacement value of the Porsche? I don't know, because
well,
it's
for sufficiency of the evidence, I'm going to go with it's what you paid for the Porsche. Just like it's what you paid for the ring, you know, I'm going to tip my hand there. But I mean, isn't your point, Ms. Minsberg? Yeah, this seems to be unfair. Well, I'm not going to say it seems to be unfair. I think it is unfair, but you know, you're bound by what you plead. And if you're pleading unjust enrichment in a real estate case, it is what it is. And you know, maybe he could, you know, I think the evidence is he was a contractor estimator. Well, then I guess I don't know why he couldn't have testified as an expert to the value, the increased value of the house in Sunfish Lake, you know, when you fix the well and when you, you know, do this and that, you know, it's worth X thousand dollars more, but you know, it is what it is. And I mean, do we really want to, I mean, what would we say then? I mean, we just say, well, I guess one way thing we could say is, you know what, that's all interesting, but if you give 180 grand and X portion of it is going to fix stuff at the house, close enough for government. I mean, what? Why couldn't we say that?
So my time is almost up. Can I answer your question?
Please do.
Okay. So you are right. You are right, Judge Connolly. He is bound by his pleading. And the case law provides a roadmap to address your question of fairness. And he had the ability to prove in the trial court what his recovery should be. And he simply chose not to do it.
Thank you. Thank you. You will have rebuttal. Counsel for the respondent, whenever you're ready, you may begin, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. I'm Dan McGrath. I represent the respondent, Paul Herlosh. This is a case about Paul Herlosh contributing nearly $300,000 in cash directly to Ms. Rux over a five-year period. Of that amount, $145,000 was paid directly to her and deposited into her personal account. Another $150,500 was deposited into a joint account at her bank account, out of which she wrote 61 of the 64 checks. She wrote those checks, and this came up on counsel's argument, for all kinds of things. She wrote it for maintenance.
Counsel? Yes. Judge Mark, and I'm going to interrupt you because we're aware of the facts, and I think there are some legal issues we need to discuss.
Sure.
I tend to agree with Judge Connolly. This seems unfair. He gave her all this money. He intended it was going to go for the house. She intended it was going to go for the house. It went for the house, and now he sues to recover. And I looked for case law that would support your assertion that he wasn't investing in the house, he was investing in the relationship, he should get his money back. I can't find any, and I'm a pretty darn good researcher.
So
what case law can you cite us to that says the measure of damages here should be anything other than the measures that is used for improvements to real estate?
Well, if I may start, Your Honor, with the Markin case. The Markin case was decided 37 years ago, almost to the day. The sentence that is argued by Ms. Rux is that investments in real estate have to be shown how that increased the value. That case involved a hole being dug in a farm. The cross-reference in that case is the Holstein v. Baker case, a 1947 case in which the plaintiff repaired fences, plowed the field, tightened up wires and cut down brush. This case is entirely different. There was money paid directly to Ms. Rux in this case. She received nearly $30,000. He was never an owner like Markin. Markin, that sentence upon which Ms. Rux relies is not found in a single case in the 37 years since that time. And more importantly, the Supreme Court has held that bright line rules of any kind are in conflict with the basic principles of equity, which require the court to weigh and balance the equities of the party. That's exactly what J.J. Abrams did in this case. And in the Melrose Gates v. Chorumua case, it says when a district court makes equitable determinations, it acts like a finder weighing all the relevant factors in considering the unique facts of the case. This is really about damages, Your Honor. And what Judge Abrams, after, and keep in mind too that the Markin case and the Nealance case, which is non-precedential, which is an entirely different case, but the Markin case was determined on summary judgment. It's about a 2.5-page opinion. And this case was tried over 3 days. There were two witnesses, Mr. Herlosh and Ms. Rux. The court, Judge Abrams, found at findings number 62 through 66, the benefits that she received. She got to live in the house that sold for $1.2 million for a period of 2.5 years. She got the contractor recovery fund, all of it from the Department of Labor and Industry. She got the refund from the American Arbitration. Yes.
I'm going to stop with two questions, because one, to back you up a bit about, you know, the Markings case is old. I looked at a case from 2012 from our Supreme Court, United Prairie Bank versus Mountain Lake v. Haugen. I believe it was written by Justice Strauss. And there's a paragraph describing what restitution damages for unjust enrichment are. And he writes that, quoting Dobbs, restitution claims are bound by a major unifying thread. Their purpose is to prevent the defendant's unjust enrichment by recapturing the gains the defendant secured in a transaction. In general, therefore, restitution is based on a benefit that has been conferred on the defendant rather than a loss incurred by the plaintiff. It differs in its goal or principle from damages, which measures the remedy by plaintiff's loss and seeks to provide compensation for that loss. So I'm of the impression, based on my research, that in the area of damages for unjust enrichment, there is this clear divide. You don't simply get the money back. It's about unjust enrichment. What was the value? And it seems like an arbitrary line, but it's there, and I don't know how we ignore it. But let's just say we're gonna go, you know, with your approach, which is, well, she got this money as a result. She got money from the recovery fund. She got the attorney deposit or the mediation fee. She got money from the arbitrator. You know, the district court didn't make any findings saying, you know, how it got to this number, other than saying she just gets all the money back. I mean, even if we could accept your theory, and I'm not sure that the law supports it, because if we're going to go with your theory, then all this restitution case law goes out the window. We just go with, well, person A gave person B money. It seems unfair because they had a joint purpose, so person A should get their money back. And we've got a bunch of case law saying that is precisely what is not supposed to happen in an equitable enrichment case. So what do we do about that?
Well, Your Honor, two points. One is the restatement of restitution first, section 150, which is cited in the in our brief, provides an action in restitution in which the benefit received is money. The measure of damages for the benefit is the amount of money received. Ms. Rux used this money organically. She used it as she saw fit. She purchased technology for her in-home office. She did maintenance work. She sealed the basement.
Let me stop you then, because I think where you're going with this is, if we have a situation where two people get engaged and they're planning for a marriage, so all of a sudden they're commingling their funds, even though they're not setting up accounts with both people's names on them. Are we opening the door? And this happens all the time, I'm quite sure of it. And I'm not aware of any cases addressing that saying, well, you know, if you were foolish enough to contribute all this money in anticipation of marriage without putting your name on it, there's no case saying you get it back. The only case I'm aware of that says you get something back when the marriage doesn't happen are the cases having to do with the engagement ring. So where are the cases that say, you get an unjust enrichment award for the amount of money contributed based on a circumstance where, you know, people are commingling funds in anticipation of marriage for something that's supposed to benefit them both as a result of marriage, but the marriage doesn't happen? Because isn't that what we have here?
Well,
because otherwise, how do we even get to this was immoral or unjust? I mean, the case law doesn't say anytime you give somebody money and, you know, they don't do with it what you wanted, you get your money back. You need to show it was immoral or unjust. So how are we getting past that hurdle under the case law?
Well, two things, Your Honor. One, in this case, the one thing that Mr. Herlosh wanted was a garage. Ms. Rux had absolute control over the scope of the project. It was always titled in her name. She made decisions with the money, both in the joint account that she maintained primary control over, by spending the money.
I understand the facts. I'm trying to take a step back and say, sure, all that's true.
Right.
Where is the case law that says that those circumstances allow you to recover your money in the form of unjust enrichment?
Well, the...
And I'm only pushing that point because we do have a lot of cases talking about people who commingle funds or invest in property in anticipation of marriage. The marriage doesn't happen. And what do we do? And I'm not finding any that say, well, you go for unjust enrichment, you get all your money back.
Your Honor, there was also a money had and received claim pled as well. And that was, and so it is a similar standard, but the point was that there was money paid directly. And really what the argument here, and I think.
Okay, but on the money had and received claim, did the district court find that claim proven and award damages on that basis?
It did not address the money had and received claim, Your Honor.
We didn't cross appeal.
No, Your Honor. No. But damages, and as the Eighth Circuit held in the Children's Broadcast Corp versus Disney, the award does not have to match any particular figure in evidence as long as the award is within the mathematical limitations established by the various witnesses and otherwise supported by the evidence as a whole. That's quoting the 1956 Minnesota Supreme Court case, Carroll v. Pratt. And further, that case held that the finder of fact is entitled to sort through the evidence in an equitable case presented at trial and arrive at what it considers to be the damages caused by the conduct it found wrongful. In this case, Mr. Herlosh had savings of $200,000 when he met Ms. Rex. In 2017, when he was asked to leave, he had $15,000 in his account. He was given $1,500 on the way out the door as he took a job in Colorado where the employer was gonna pay for his housing and for his travel out to Colorado.
Does appellant, I'm looking at appellant's brief. She doesn't seem to challenge liability under unjust enrichment. It's just a measure of damages, unless I'm misreading it. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding, and there's also really no standard of review cited other than de novo in appellant's brief in either of the two briefs. And I will also point out, Your Honor, the word expert shows up 10 times in appellant's principal brief and 13 times in the reply brief. The word expert does not appear in either the Markin case or the Nealance case.
I give you that. I don't think you need an expert to establish the value of your home. I think we have case law saying that an owner of real estate is competent to testify regarding value and I assume value of improvements. But the question I have is, and the circumstances, your client is very sympathetic given how this turned out for him.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you're seeming to say that, well, unjust enrichment means that anybody who made kind of regrettable decisions and handed over money to somebody without putting things in writing and without clearly defining what their right was going to be, they get their money back. And I don't know that equitable enrichment sweeps that broadly, because then it seems like, boy, we would have a lot of cases where people are like, because we always say, well, why didn't you have a contract? Why didn't you put it in writing? Why didn't you get a joint checking account? It seems like all of this was preventable, and these were decisions your client made. So I'm just struggling with the notion that you would at least not have to make some attempt to comply with the damage measure that has been recognized related to real estate when you can't cite any other law that says, yeah, this is a situation in which equitable enrichment has been applied and the provider just gets their money back.
First of all, Your Honor, we didn't have any information about the lawsuit with the sellers. That was introduced on the third day of trial. So this idea that we could have somehow created some algebraic formula or logarithm, we were not afforded the opportunity to do that. So what was the value?
Couldn't you at least present evidence regarding what was the value of, what did she pay for the property? What was the value when these two got together and started using their funds to improve it? And then, like Judge Connolly said, what were the values of improvements? Lord knows I've bought enough houses to know that there are some things where the realtor will say, well, yeah, you'll get your money back out of the new kitchen, but you're not going to get your money back out of a new deck because people expect you to maintain your deck. So I don't know that you can just say, well, you spent $30,000 on a deck, therefore it increased the value of your property. Why couldn't you have had somebody, even your own client, if he's in the trades, kind of talk about what improvements were made with their commingled funds and how those improvements generally increase the value of a home?
He didn't know what Ms. Rux was using those funds for. She wrote checks out to for
right,
the legal proceeding.
But he lived in the home and he was aware of the improvements that had been made to the home, yes?
And the maintenance, and didn't fully understand or appreciate what she had done after. And then when she sold the home, she refused to produce copies of the closing documents and the purchase agreement for months until after closing. I mean, this was done, it was to the extent that we were supposed to have the evidence to, what, an expert to determine the value of the improvements, the value of the recovery that she received, the value of what she the money that she received, the appreciation of the stock. As Judge Abrams, keep in mind, Judge Abrams listened to these two people, two witnesses, for a total of 3 days, and weighing credibility rests solely with the trial court, as do damage awards, Your Honor. So because I submit that the evidence sustains the findings of fact and the findings of fact sustain the conclusions of law, I would ask that the court affirm the trial court's judgment in full. I would also close with the maxim that a court of equity regards that as done which ought to have been done, and that's the Gary v. Nelson Supreme Court case cited in the brief. It's from 90 years ago, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Minsberg, you'll have the last word, please. Actually, could you start by addressing that quote? Because, you know, in looking at the Nyland case, you know, the language that I find that hurts you the most is, in order to establish a claim for unjust enrichment, the claimant must show that another party knowingly received something of value to which he was not entitled, and that the circumstances are such that it would be unjust for the person to retain that benefit. And then it goes on to say, additionally, it must be shown that a party was unjustly enriched in the sense that the term unjustly could mean illegally or unlawfully, which has since been extended to also apply where the defendant's conduct in retaining the benefit is morally wrong. Now, that sounds like something we could hang our hat on if we wanted to reverse this case. Now, I will say, in the interest of full disclosure, the next line is, it is generally the extent of the benefit unjustly retained by the opposing party and not the extent of the claimant's expenditure of loss. So,
Judge Connolly, I think that's the problem. You know, the first thing you described is he has to prove that there's a basis to award unjust enrichment by showing it was morally wrong. I've got no problem saying this was morally wrong. I mean, I don't think that's really contested here. But then the next step is, okay, if you show it's morally wrong to have retained some benefit, what's the value of the benefit?
Ms. Minsberg, are you saying that none of this, apart from the ring, because that's kind of different, mm-hmm. is it your contention, that the rest of the, and I'm just going to throw, you know, the 250... that all of that is just gone because all of that relates to no evidence which could be shown to that the value of the house was improved. You're saying none of that's all gone. Is that your position, Ms. Minsberg?
You're muted.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not sure what you're referring to when you said all of that is gone.
No damages.
Reversed. I mean, yeah. Let's say for the sake of speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I view the ring differently. And I don't know. Let's say that's worth 250, or not 250, 25. And the rest of it, I thought it was about 280. So, you know, you subtract 25 from 280. Is all that, you know, whatever that is, 55. I don't know. I'm not good at math. So you're saying none of the remaining 255 is supported by the evidence. It's gone. It's not, it's reversed. You know, that's void. Is that your position, Ms. Mintzberg? None of it can be associated with an increase in the value of the house.
That is my position, Judge Connolly. And because it does seem unfair. However, as I said in the initial argument, the respondent had a roadmap through the case law of how to prove his claim. He chose not to. And that is not my client's fault. That is not her problem. If someone as a plaintiff does not prove their claim, they lose. Don't forget, Marking was summary judgment. Nylands was summary judgment. This court in Nylands talked about the fact that Mr. Nylands invested significant dollars into Ms. Perry's home and her business, but said he didn't prove the increase in value. And remember, in Nylands, it said that a market analysis, which is someone who has experience in the industry, said that wasn't good enough. So there's a couple steps you have to do. First, what's the increase of the value of the real estate? And Judge Larkin, you talked about, you know, different times, and that's what someone would have to look at. What was the value when they first started the improvements? What was the value when he left? So, and then you get whatever that number is. And then what Nyland says, you have to-
Why isn't, okay, is there evidence in the record that says she paid X for the house? And is there evidence in the record that said she sold the house for Y? So why isn't it, you know, Y minus X? And I don't know what that number is. I've forgotten the numbers.
Because in Nylands, it talks about market forces, and you have to take into account market forces. And that.
So let me ask this question just for the group to think about. What if he invests this money in the house and the market tanks? And when she sells at a loss. Does he still get his money back on the notion that he gave her all this money to use as she saw fit and she used it for the house?
I mean, if it's an unjust enrichment claim, no, because there wasn't a benefit, she lost.
But you only get, so the person gets, the homeowner would get to keep the benefit of an increase of market value, and a person would be capped by their expenditures. But then the homeowner takes, but the other person doesn't get the, is harmed by the loss. I mean, it seems like the person who's not the owner, it's a one-way street for them. They either get the maximum of their expenditures or they get zero. And the other person who owns it gets either the benefit or the advantage or the risk.
Judge Smith, I think instead it's sort of a percentage of the pain either way. So you look at what's the increase in market value, if there's an increase, take off the market forces, and then look at what did she invest in the home? What did he invest in the home? And then he would get, I see your hand up.
When you're finished, I have a question about the ring we need to get to before you're done.
And so you'd look at the relative percentage. So if the house increased X and he put in, let's say, one third of the improvements, he would get one third of that increase. But he has to prove it, and he didn't.
As to the ring, I tend to agree with you. It's a replevin claim, and I think the district court erred by saying, I'm not going to treat this as replevin because he no longer has, the ring's not available. I mean, we have a statute that says for replevin, you either give back the item or you give its value. You argue two things. You argue it has to be current market value. And I question why it's current market value and not the value of the ring when it became unavailable, when she traded it in. Then you argue, well, the proper award of damages there is she should have to give him the three pieces of jewelry she received on trade. I don't see any law supporting that. I mean, the statute says it's the item, the ring, or market value. So tell me what your authority is for the propositions that it's current market value, as in time of trial, as opposed to when the ring was traded in, and what your authority is for the proposition that the damages should be her turning over the tag, her watch, and the bracelet, and the necklace.
So with jewelry, the problem with jewelry is it's like a car. The minute you walk out the door, the value decreases. In retail,
unless you buy Tiffany.
Pardon me?
I said, unless you buy Tiffany. there are exceptions.
So the market value is not the retail value. And so if you have this ring, what is the market value of this ring? What could the respondent get for cash for this ring?
So why isn't the receipt from Borsheim saying, we've taken this ring in on trade, we're essentially giving you X dollars in cash to spend in our store? Why isn't that sufficient evidence of the market value?
Because that's not cash, because there's such a significant markup of jewelry. And so if this jewelry were if you had someone come in and say, what is this ring worth? And the cash offer for the ring was significantly less, then here we'll get, you can trade in. And you'll find that if you go to a jewelry store, here, I want you to buy this ring, you know, sell a ring on consignment. They'll give you roughly half of what they would give you for trade-in because of the significant markup in jewelry. And so the offer, there is no case law that says he should get the jewelry, but that is giving him more money. And then he can do with that jewelry what he wants. If you did the cash value of that
jewelry. Well, how is that fair? If she got this jewelry how many years ago and she's worn it and it's dinged up, it's not worth what it was worth when she got it new. How is that a fair measure of damages?
The hope was that it would be more fair to him than the cash value. If you went to the jewelry store and said, here are these three pieces of jewelry, give me the money for it. And frankly, the ring at the time, for example, it's a yellow diamond. Yellow diamonds are not popular at all anymore. So they're worth significantly less. But the idea is the same thing. Replevin, it's his burden to say, here's the value. And there was no one there to say the value.
The case on that, I think we are just dealing with sufficiency of the evidence to support the damage award that the district court used. And my understanding of the case law is that we are deferential. We don't need anything that's exact. We just need something in the record that says it's within the realm of reasonable probability such that it's not speculative. I have a hard time understanding why we would say the amount that Borsheim's agreed to give for the ring is not the market value we should use. Or, you know, and you can argue about whether it should be something else, but given the deferential standard that we use when assessing sufficiency of the evidence to support a damage award, and just sort of that, is it within the realm of reasonable possibility? I don't see why that measure is not adequate, even though you could argue for other measures.
I guess the reason I think that it's not adequate is the cash value with jewelry is very different than the retail value of jewelry.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within 90 days. That being our only oral argument for the day, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You're welcome.